So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Marty Jannetty is down and out. Patented crescent kick by the champion. Hooks the leg, the referee's down.
It's over.
He got him. What a miscarriage of justice.
He's slapping on the...
He's got the sharpshooter. He's got that leg twisted around.
He's got him.
He's got him. Yes! We're under the 10-second mark once again. Who will it be? It is Carlos Colon, the Caribbean champion. A lot of fire in this youngster.
And we don't care about the young folks talking about the outside.
It's Review Away. I am John Pollock, joined as always by Wei Ting. It is Royal Rumble season. We're going to be tackling the 1993 edition on today's show. How are you, Mr. Ting?
Very well. I'm excited. This is the playoffs. It's our playoffs season.
You're right. You're right, because we're on our road to wrestling's version of the Grey Cup.
Yeah. Or
everyone says the Super Bowl. I'd say what about the Grey Cup? Not getting any love. Have you ever been a CFL fan, Wei? Ever?
No.
I can't say I have been. In my life, I've gone to one Argos game.
I don't even know the rules of football, man. Why would I watch Canadian football?
It just seems like every sports team, you go into some phase. I mean, I've been a fanatic at times about the Jays. I've been a fanatic at times about the Leafs, about the Raptors. Never the Argonauts. Never.
I feel like Canadian football is sort of a fringe sport, you know? I think we all want to watch the best in the world. And if you're playing in the Canadian Football League, you're essentially in a minors, you know, division.
Yeah. I remember it was very glaring once when my sister told me that two of the Toronto Argonauts came to speak at her class. I was like, that's kind of cool. You had two major league athletes come.
No.
And my sister was like, yeah, they work in the offseason. I'm like, they work. At least one of them did. I'm like, what does he do? He's a football player. He's like, oh, he works at the grocery store. I was like, what?
Oh, no.
Works at the grocery store. And like, listen, I'm not here to judge. I think that's awful that you're a professional athlete and you have to work in the offseason. I think that's kind of ridiculous, but hey.
What qualifies as a professional athlete? You can look at UFC fighters and think that they're actual professional athletes.
Yeah, many wrestlers say they don't consider themselves professional wrestlers until they make their full-time living in the industry.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think it's just such a drastic difference from what NFL players make versus your typical CFL player.
I believe the last time I was at an Argos game, you and I went to go interview Bret Hart on the field before he was doing some coin toss or something or other.
Yeah.
Maybe he was throwing the ball. Was he doing something with the ball, I recall?
He was doing something. He maybe had to toss it or something like that.
So this person on the field comes up to me and is convinced I'm Ariel Helwani. And I had to inform him I was not.
I feel like you've had that many times.
It's happened a few times.
Might be the flannel. Shaved head.
I guess. I don't know. I didn't even have my shaved head at that point.
Oh, you didn't?
In 2010. No, that was a later decision.
You guys look nothing alike.
I don't think so either. I don't think we look anything alike.
Yeah.
But for some reason, that happened in Halifax that time we were in a cab.
You did dress up as him for Halloween one year.
I did for Halloween, but I mean, yeah. I didn't go like this. I needed an Expos hat. I needed a tie.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But it all comes back to Bret Hart, doesn't it?
Yes, that's how I remember Argos moments.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
They're actually moving into our neighborhood here in Liberty Village.
I'm not looking forward to that. We work here in Liberty Village. Wait, you wait till you see the traffic here. And it's not just that.
You don't even
I mean,
drive.
The Winter Classic is probably going to be here next year.
Yeah.
At BMO.
Would be exciting.
Go somewhere else.
It'll actually be really bad for the bars around here. Like if we want to get a table now at local, for instance, forget that.
I'm not convinced the Argos at BMO Field is going to rejuvenate this franchise. I think it'll get some curiosity that they're in a new venue, and certainly they need to be in a smaller one than they are at the Rogers Center.
I'm just thinking about all the people we're alienating with.
Nobody, wait. There are no CFL listeners on this show, okay? I'm pretty safe. This is a safe subject to bash the CFL. But nonetheless, listen, I hope the Argos do well, but I don't think that this is going to be this giant thing that the Argos are selling out all their games.
I'm trying to think of a listener out in maybe like Scotland listening to this and how little they would care about the rejuvenation of the Toronto Argos franchise as a result of their moving.
You know, the CFL, outside of Toronto, you go to some smaller cities in Canada, like Saskatchewan.
Yeah,
they're gigantic. Winnipeg.
Oh yeah,
CFL is massive in other areas.
Well, they got nothing.
Just Toronto doesn't care.
Yeah, they got nothing else going on.
Well, there you go. Maybe the Argonauts shouldn't be in Toronto. I don't think you need to be. This is a team that quite often loses money. I don't believe you need a team in Toronto for the CFL to flourish.
You know, I don't know the financials. I imagine.
Do you want to review the Grey Cup next week? We can do a whole breakdown of the business of the CFL. We'll get on to a sports reporter in the city who can school us on the business of the CFL in Toronto.
Why don't you review it, and maybe I'll take that week off and not listen.
I remember, this is my last CFL joke, was in grade 4, I believe it was, and there was this kid in our class, and it was the day after the Grey Cup, and one of my friends said, "Hey, did you watch the Grey Cup last night?" And he's like, "No, I don't watch hockey." And it became like the biggest joke that we always brought up. Because technically, the Stanley Cup, if you're going to assign a color to it, it would probably be gray.
It's a silver.
It's a silver.
Yeah.
Closer to gray. It's in the family of gray.
Okay, fine.
But nonetheless, we hounded this poor guy.
We will maybe someday, you know, if you're going to tie in a wrestling relevant review of any CFL game, it would have to be an Edmonton Eskimos game, circa Roman Reigns appearance.
We would have to, or maybe The Rock.
Oh, he was on a
Lex CFL. Luger.
Wow.
Roman Reigns. There's a huge tie-in of CFL and professional wrestlers.
Yeah.
And world champions, no less. I mean, the CFL was the original NXT.
It clearly is the path.
It was a better developmental league than some of the WWE's own in-house developmental promotions.
Well, when you actually think about it, I mean, it does make a bit of sense, you know, if you're a football player, if you have kind of the athleticism to become a professional football player, yet you're not necessarily good enough to make it into the NFL, you're probably going to end up in a place like the CFL. And, you know, what else do those people have in common with professional wrestling? Failed football careers.
And, I mean, if you're on the practice squad of a CFL team, it's probably comparable money to an entry-level developmental deal at NXT. You're looking mid to low five figures.
Yeah, except you probably wouldn't be encouraged to have a grocery store job if you're in developmental.
You wouldn't be encouraged to, but some guys...
Do they? In developmental? They got
I never hear of that.
Yeah.
Other ways to make money. However, I mean, some... I would say a lot of your expenses are somewhat taken care of.
Do you think Mojo Rawley has a side job?
I would love to know what it would be if it really was. But, I mean, imagine if you were making like $30,000 a year. I mean, you're not – you got to be pretty conservative with your funds.
I wonder if your food gets paid for, though. Like if you get meals at the Performance Center paid for.
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if there's food on hand. I mean, they have a beautiful facility. You would think it's stocked with at least like water and stuff. Their old facility, they used to note how – at FCW, they'd have to leave the actual building to go to a washroom, like down the street or something like that.
Right.
Like, it was awful.
Yeah.
So, there you go. If you're an aspiring wrestler, don't think of WrestleMania. You got to think of going down the street with a full bladder searching for a dirty urinal. Okay? You got to... Oh, look at that. That's a...
You should just, like... Come on, man. That's like the fifth time in the past.
I know. It's really bad. Since we've had to get this new email, so I've had to set up Outlook.
Okay.
You excited to chat about the 1993 Royal Rumble?
I have been until you, you know, I feel like we've been bullshitting about a CFL and TV shows for like 20 minutes.
Now, before we start this with the 93 Royal Rumble, were you engaged in the final 10 minutes of the Royal Rumble, or did you big time me earlier this morning?
What do you mean?
I walked into your office
yeah.
and saw you there with your headphones on,
yeah.
intently watching this Rumble, taking
yeah.
notes.
Yeah.
I walked up to you.
What?
I waved at you.
Oh, I don't remember this
you
at all.
You didn't move. I turn around and George is standing there, and he's like,
He's there too?
Yes. At the door. I literally walked in and was 90 degrees to your left and moved my hand waving.
Oh my God.
And I was
wondering why you didn't let me know that you were here.
Well,
so we could do this review.
I came in and then I looked at George. I'm like, he looks really focused or he just doesn't want to talk to me. And we both laughed. Like I've never been so close to a person and made a movement and nothing from
I
you.
Really.
So you, I felt you were locked in because you're not the big timing type.
I really had no clue that you were anywhere within my presence. You could.
This was awesome.
You're not making this up?
I swear.
Wow.
I swear.
That's very funny. Well, I had my headphones on, and I guess I was kind of focused on this.
Yes, you were. So I just,
sorry about that.
No, not at all. The review is going to reap the rewards of your focus.
And I didn't really want to talk to you.
So. That's probably true. I knew yeah. there was a hint of that in there, but I wanted to try and just get that out of my brain.
Well, I knew I had an hour and a half to come, so.
Did you know that we have guests on this show?
No idea.
Plural. Wow. Plural.
Bob Backlund.
Bob Backlund is not on this particular show. You know, in that whole discussion I had with him, so little of it was actually on this particular run for Backlund and being the marathon man this year in the Rumble. So mm-hmm. maybe one day we'll have Bob Backlund back on. I will say, now that we're done all our awards, if there was an award for most pleasant man to deal with, Bob Backlund would be my pick in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was so just, I called him, by the way. We did this the day before U.S. Thanksgiving, which is a holiday I never typically think of when yeah. I'm getting American guests on. That it's a holiday for these people. We call each other. He's at the train station on the way to go see his family and could not have been more accommodating with his time and thanking me for the interview. Just being a very pleasant individual.
Cool.
So that's my personal story about Bob Backlund.
He was I think we had a bit of an interaction with him at WrestleMania this year too. He was one of the
That's right.
He was one of the talents that the PR people would kind of parade around to shake people's hands.
They do it every year. They come around and they have a legend just to yep. say hello to all of the media members.
And this year it was Sarge and it was Bob Backlund and Mr. Backlund was very, very nice. Offered to put people in the crossface chicken wing on
which
the spot.
Some media people asked him to do, and they did.
I kind of regret not asking myself.
I shook his hand, and I said, nice to meet you. And that was it. So there you go. Oh, yeah. The WrestleMania press box stories. I feel we're going to do a separate show this year about our WrestleMania media box experience.
Wow.
More stories for us this year came out of that media press box than did WrestleMania.
Sure. We should measure the thickness of the glass. This year, I'm actually very excited for it because it's at this Texas Dallas Stadium,
AT&T Stadium,
which I think a lot of people are saying is an event in and of itself, just a visit.
Oh yeah, this thing is it's a monster.
Yeah, so
this venue.
I think we'll have plenty to talk about.
Yes, but today we're chatting about the Royal Rumble in the much more modest Arco Arena in Sacramento, California. Our guest, by the way. Two important players on this show. One, we're going to hear a clip from Bret Hart because the original plan was not for him to face Razor Ramon on this show. He had another opponent that he was scheduled to have. We'll hear from him on that. And we're going to hear from Marty Jannetty.
Oh.
The tumultuous journey of Marty Jannetty. We're going to hear from him. These are older interviews that we conducted. The Marty Jannetty interview that we did, it was about 5.5 years ago. It's outstanding.
Cool.
And you walk away from it just, this is a guy that knows he squandered so many opportunities, and he readily admits it's the saddest comment maybe ever in a law interview. He says, I think Dan asks him, do you think a lot about all these opportunities and what could have been and just different choices you could have made? And his comment is something to the effect of, I think about it every morning I wake up and every night when I go to sleep.
Damn.
So we'll hear from Marty Jannetty about the interesting relationship with Shawn Michaels and some stuff that curbed their feud. And this was one of the few singles matches they were able to have. this particular event way had two different posters because there was the original version, which featured the Ultimate Warrior and British Bulldog, who were let go in October for some...
Let me look it up. I didn't know that.
Yes. This original poster also featured Tito Santana and Papa Shango, who were on the event, but the new poster removed Warrior, Bulldog, Santana, and Papa Shango and inserted Mr. Perfect. Because, obviously, Warrior and Bulldog were two of their, you could argue, their two top baby faces at that point, coming off of Wembley Stadium with Bulldog, and Ultimate Warrior, who we'll get into a little later on, was figured into a big way on this show.
Which poster are you referring to? Like, this one with... This one?
Yes.
The one with the...
In the bottom wrestler? Collage of wrestlers. Yeah, you might have to search for the different versions, but one version...
Oh, yeah, I see the Warrior version right now.
Yes.
The first one up there. Interesting.
So this was when their drug policy was ultra strict in 1992, and Warrior and Bulldog were apprehended, I should say, and let go by the company, which was a sign of how serious they were.
What were their programs?
Going into this...
Yeah, leading into the Rumble.
I mean, the Bulldog was... originally, Warrior was set for the Survivor Series to team with Randy Savage, and when Warrior was released... They brought back Mr. Perfect to take that spot. And then, well, we'll get into a little later on, but he was going to face Bret Hart on this show for the WWF title.
Interesting.
And Bulldog, I don't know what the exact direction was, but he dropped the Intercontinental title to Shawn Michaels in October, and then he too was let go. Mm. So the fact that these were two major players, and the WWF not just suspended them, fired them, was a big sign of how serious they were about testing in 1992.
And it seemed like a rather large blow to the roster at the time, which I think was quickly starting to deplete on its way to.
Oh, and the Rumble was a pretty evident sign of where the depth issues were.
Mm-hmm.
It took about 10 seconds for this show to start before we got a crowd shot featuring Stu Hart, who Stu and Helen sat at ringside the entire night for this show.
Mm-hmm.
Helen, God bless this woman. I think she was bored out of her mind.
Not during her son's match.
No. For her son's match, she's awesome.
Yeah.
Because she believes that he's in trouble.
Yeah.
She's shielding her eyes.
Yeah.
But the rest of the show, this poor woman.
I mean, they do kind of, they're, you know, even at this stage, they were pretty old. And
that's a long time to sit.
You can't necessarily tell if they're incredibly gripped by the action or just.
Did they have to be against the hard camera? I mean, give them the option to head backstage.
They just wanted to treat them nicely.
Man.
But, yeah, Helen Hart, a fixture throughout this entire show. I mean, if people remember our review of, what was that? Was it a Survivor Series that...
Survivor Series 94 with the towel.
My MVP of that match was Helen Hart.
The best Hart worker on that show.
And so I was definitely looking forward to her performance coming up later in this match between Bret and Razor.
The announcers for tonight's show, Gorilla Monsoon. Actually, I shouldn't say tonight. This was a pay-per-view when they would run them Sunday afternoons. 4 p.m. Eastern, this aired.
Wow.
Could you imagine watching these Sunday pay-per-views in the afternoon?
It's like being on the West Coast.
Exactly. Well, on the West Coast, 1 in the afternoon. I would love that.
A lunch Royal Rumble party.
Everyone gets so worried about the WWF doing a pay-per-view from the UK or something and how it would alter the times. I mean,
it was
a different era, but these pay-per-views weren't always Sunday nights.
What is the time difference? Six hours?
5 hours. 5 hours to London.
5 hours earlier, so let's say, so it would be like 3 in the afternoon for us.
Which is what the NXT special was last month.
Okay, which is fine.
I think that the WWE doing a pay-per-view overseas, I don't think it's hardly the risk people think it would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, a few hours off, even if you were to air it on pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it would be fine.
But I feel like now these days, I mean, I guess they have a lot more leeway right now with the network, but I imagine like things were probably very set in stone with pay-per-view at the time. I don't know.
Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan are the announced team, and Bobby Heenan is so excited for the debut of Narcissus.
Narcissus.
One of the worst names ever.
I don't know why he pronounced it that way.
That was the original name. They didn't like it. They changed it to the Narcissist.
But it was spelled Narcissist on his graphic.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
C-I-S-T.
Oh, well, he was always referred to it The beginning is Narcissus.
Heaton was so excited about the Narcissus this entire show.
Well,
I thought he was just great on this entire thing.
Bobby Heenan. We'll get into it with the Lex Luger debut. I mean, if ever there was a guy who, I mean, salvaged what I thought was a pretty awful debut.
Yeah.
Bobby Heenan deserves every ounce of credit for that segment.
Yeah.
We kicked off with the Beverly Brothers and the Steiner Brothers in a battle of outfits. Singlets versus tights. These four were decked out to the nines way. These were outstanding.
Yeah.
If I could have been a wrestler, I would have wanted to be a Beverly Brother with these purple tights with stars and other weird graphical elements on my tights.
Mm-hmm. It seemed oddly out of place, though, for this type of gimmick to exist by 1992, I feel like this is very much like, you know, in the style of, like, the Nature Boy and, you know, big robe, big hair, and I guess, in this case, two rather generic wrestlers.
Did you notice the fifth man in the ring?
No.
Bill Alfonso was the referee.
Ah, right.
The Steiners had debuted with the WWF the month prior in December and had just worked the Tokyo Dome that year.
For New Japan.
Yes, like right. 3 weeks before this. And against Hawk and Kensuke Sasaki. So
very cool.
The Steiners all over the place.
I really liked watching the old school Steiner brothers here in this carnation, if only for the drastically different appearance of Scott Steiner from back then versus, of course, today. But also Scott Steiner's in-ring style at this time, he was just far more technical and agile. And, you know, he had a gimmick based off of a collegiate wrestling background versus, you know, a gimmick based off of a bodybuilder.
I really enjoyed this tag match. They got this crowd, they got so much heat just from Bo complaining about Scott pulling his hair. Gorilla notes here that he took a cab over to the Arco Arena, and his driver was telling him that he could have sold his Royal Rumble ticket for 50 times its worth. This cab driver could have made his salary off this Royal Rumble, which was legitimately sold out in the Arco Arena. So this was a hot ticket in Sacramento. The Steiners had the advantage early. The Beverlys would go to the floor. Crowd just loved the Steiners. Rick runs in. Nails Bo off the apron. There's a belly-to-belly by Scott where he basically deadlifts Blake in order to hit this belly-to-belly. Blake is choking Scott with the tag rope, a spot we never see any longer. I guess choking is still outlawed, even with the tag rope. Got a lot of heat throughout this. Scott hit this like double underhook suplex, almost Tiger Driver-esque, and then Rick got the tag. He murders each of these guys with clotheslines, especially Bo. I mean, this was just took his head off.
Came off of work in New Japan.
Yeah, he was still in New Japan mode. Scott is hitting punches in the corner, then is lifted by Blake on his shoulders. As a child, I always remembered this spot because I thought it was so cool where Bo comes off the top, but he misses Scott in the electric chair position because Scott goes down into a victory roll.
Mm-hmm.
I always remembered this. And then Scott gets up, and kills Blake with this Frankensteiner. He goes down and just crushes his neck and lands right on top of it and pins him at 10:45. Poor Blake here. If you watch the way he goes down, this is just awful.
Maybe he called it a Hurricane Rana. And Scott was like, don't you dare.
Called it a what?
Fucking her and Karana. I thought for 93 this was very good. The Steiners, again, I'm very impressed with them at this time because I think my impression of them today is just so different. But at this time, I thought they were both very well-rounded in the ring, and especially Scott, who I think was a standout in-ring guy here. Very technical, very high-flying. Rick with very good power moves. And the two of them, you know, just even a month in, I thought they were very likable baby faces, just seeing them with their first impressions.
Yeah, and Bobby Heenan tried to do his brain scan, which was malfunctioning here as we replayed the victory roll spot and into the finish. Then they showed us a video package on the history of the Rockers, stemming from their longtime team into the barbershop angle, which is one of the truly great angles period in company history, one that is constantly cited, even Jeez, 24 years later.
T-shirt store dedicated to
yeah,
that name.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then just an angle I think that doesn't get its due was the follow-up to this. Because yeah. right after the barbershop angle, everyone was like, what happened to this? Well, Jannetty got he was arrested, and he got arrested on possession and resisting arrest. One of his many wow. firings from the WWF, and therefore Shawn Michaels, new character, hot angle, got to open up WrestleMania against Tito Santana.
When did the angle take place? When did the breakup take place?
January of 92 is when it aired on television.
Okay, so this was a full year after the angle.
Yeah, because Jannetty was let go. Mm-hmm. And then this angle where he returned, mm-hmm. Was he went into USWA for a little, then came back in October of 92, totally reeking of October of 1992 with a Guns N' Roses shirt, acid wash jeans, and cowboy boots. I mean, holy shit. Did this guy subscribe to the fashion of his era? So Jannetty shows up. Michaels is posing in his mirror, and the camera is looking in the mirror as you see Jannetty come into the reflection, and Michaels' face sells it like it's Jacob Marley that is showing up, and Ebenezer Scrooge is about to get fucked. Awesome call by Vince McMahon during this angle. And then Jannetty grabs the mirror and goes to hit Michaels, who pulls Sherry in front, and Jannetty waffles Sherry with the mirror by mistake. Wait, this angle might be at the same level of the barbershop, even though it's not remembered to a tenth of the degree that the barbershop breakup is.
I thought this angle was so great, and I myself had forgotten about it. I think you're right. Everybody talks about the barbershop window angle of the breakup of the Rockers, but few people remember this, perhaps because the payoff wasn't that great. But I thought the mirroring here of the barbershop window angle
nice.
With Sean's mirror versus, you know, taking Marty's face into the glass, I thought it was just great imagery that I don't usually expect out of professional wrestling. And, you know, Sean pulling Sherry in to protect himself did a lot to promote Sean as this piece of shit. And, again, added, I guess, a level of tragedy to this Marty Jannetty guy who, you know, even in trying to get revenge, can't do it. It pretty much broke up him, Sherry and Sean, though, but I think it also furthered Sean, you know, towards his next step as a heel.
And clearly was building up to a broken glass match at WrestleMania 8. Like, that's the only way you could have gone here.
Broken glass match.
Oh, yeah, with panes of glass all over, going wow. combat zone. What
could,
else could you have done at the Hoosier
they
Dome?
They should have saved it for WrestleMania next year.
We now go back to the arena. Howard Finkel introduces Sensational Sherry, making her first appearance since her face was obliterated
yeah.
in this angle.
I remember seeing like the angle for the first time on like Wrestling Challenge or something, and it actually was a very violent sight. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah,
a woman getting her face smashed in with a mirror, to the point where like they would always not just blur it out, they would put a big black band with the word censored
can't
over top
see that
of it.
Shit on television.
So like as a kid, my imagination is just like running wild. Like what does this look like? Is she completely disfigured? You know,
theater of the mind.
Yeah, yeah. So. But
and as great as Bobby Heenan was for the barbershop angle, Vince McMahon during the Sherry angle, he was outstanding. I mean, when this guy had to sell a big angle, there was no one better than Vince McMahon in the 80s or early 90s. He was just, I thought he was great. Sherry comes out in this big red dress and more cleavage than probably any WWF broadcast has ever featured up until this point in time. Up until
sure.
this point in time.
Yes.
They would raise the bar.
Oh, yeah.
Jannetty comes out, and so he had returned back in October, and there would be more drama for Marty Jannetty coming out of this match, but we will get into the match first. Michaels comes out in this awesome gold outfit. I mean, just you had to hate this man for what he was wearing alone. And this was also one of the final times he came out to the Sensational Sherry version of the Heartbreak Kid song, a song that is stunning, that it has lasted the test of time, a real moment and legacy builder for Shawn Michaels. But I always I always loved the Sherry version. I thought it was fantastic.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. Monsoon calls him the wrestler of the 90s.
Kind of true.
Yeah. Dang. So Shawn Michaels, Marty Jannetty. This was their, maybe their most high profile match. They would have future singles matches in 93, but this was a big one. The Battle of the Mullets between the two former members of the Rockers. And Michaels is just playfully shoving Jannetty and then eats a punch, and Heenan is just immediately yelling, "Take a walk, take a walk." This was Heenan in fine form.
Mm-hmm.
And then this knee lift comes and Michaels flies over the top to the floor, and it's essentially all Marty Jannetty to start the match, and Michaels showcasing just his great ability to sell and bump all the over the place for the babyface.
Well, I don't know if
was it too comical for you?
Yeah, like I definitely felt like, especially in the early on in this match, Shawn was had a bit of his Hulk Hogan SummerSlam working boots on here, jumping a little too high, a little bit too ridiculously for some of this offense.
Okay, then we go to one of the most fascinating spots, Way, that I'm going to really... I spent a lot of time thinking about this.
Okay.
Michaels lifts up Jannetty and runs him shoulder first into the steel post. This is the whole basis of the match, is going to be working around Jannetty's injured shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows in the U.S., you always work the left side of the body. In Mexico, it's different. You work the right side. But in the U.S., it's always the left side. Michaels runs the right shoulder of Marty Jannetty into the post.
Oh, okay.
So Marty, as he lands, grabs the left shoulder, and they continue just working the left shoulder. So here is my philosophical question for you, Way. Who was wrong? Was Jannetty wrong for selling the shoulder that was not run into the shoulder, or for the sake of how the match is all built around the shoulder, is it better to just flip on the fly and go to the traditional left side to avoid future problems in the match?
Well, I think that question, it depends a lot on what was agreed upon, if they even had that type of agreement. I mean, I would expect that nothing would be really out of the ordinary, and I would just assume that, you know, Michaels or somebody messed up in attacking that.
I think it's safe to say Michaels screwed up. Because it should have been the left shoulder.
And you also have to consider how much of Michaels' offense after this point could be quickly changed on the fly to attack the right side instead of the left side.
See, I think this is a good question for someone who's an experienced veteran and a trainer.
Okay.
So as I was taking my notes here, I was fascinated by this question of what should be your reaction to something like this if you're Marty Jannetty. So I asked our pal Lance Storm, what would you do in this kind of a situation?
Awesome.
And here was his reply, okay, from Lance Storm.
Oh, you actually emailed Lance.
Oh, yes.
Great.
Yes, he probably thought, what the fuck is he bothering me with? But here is Lance's response to this. I would suggest not fucking the spot up in the first place and running the proper shoulder into the post. Marty may have not even noticed. He threw the guy into the post, he grabbed the shoulder, and then Shawn worked that shoulder. Had Marty just said, I think had Shawn just said, shit, I ran the wrong shoulder into the post and sold his right one, there is no problem with them working the right side, provided nothing they have planned later only works from the left side. I doubt many fans, especially at the time, even noticed. Hope this helps.
I mean, I certainly didn't notice, and I don't know how many people out there would have, so good for you, John, for being a keener. I'll tell you what, though, what adds to a bit of the confusion is because Gorilla Monsoon on commentary here, I don't know if you noted this, but at one point Gorilla asks, why is Shawn working on Marty's left shoulder since Marty isn't a southpaw? It's interesting because...
Well, Monsoon then clearly picked up on the fact the right shoulder was run into the post.
He didn't state that, though.
Mm-hmm.
He stated it...
That could have been a... That's an interesting one. I feel maybe if the announcer calls that... Listen, if I was calling a match like this and clearly saw that a mistake happened and they're adjusting, I'm not going to call that out and then take the match down for my own credibility's sake.
Yes. But I don't even know if Monsoon noticed that initial error. You know, I think this was just Gorilla legitimately bringing up like a very interesting question. Like, if this was a real fight, and I appreciate when an announcer can, you know,
he's kind of overlooking a major spot though, which was the post spot. I mean, that was the heat for the match set up.
Yeah, and you know, I just chalk that up to people not being as detailed of a viewer as perhaps somebody like yourself. But like, I found it interesting that Gorilla would kind of be, you know, willingly to kind of poke holes into the match like that. And you know, it's very interesting that it there's like another layer to that question that you just identified.
This is one of the most fascinating spots we've reviewed in years. Way I was just. I just watched this, and my first reaction was, oh, they screwed up the shoulder spot. And then started really thinking about it. I was like, who is actually wrong here? Should you just react? Okay, this mistake happened, but we got to adjust on the fly. Now it's the right shoulder. That's what we've showcased.
If I screwed that up, I would probably just run you again into the ropes or into the post with the proper shoulder. And I just work both shoulders.
Work both, and then just cover your tracks that way.
Yeah.
You could do that, I guess, too. The shoulder is the focus of all the offense after this. Heenan does great commentary about the fact that Jannetty won't be able to put on a coat after this. I mean, Heenan was so great at just descriptive ways to inform the viewer what pain this babyface is in.
Yeah, and his enthusiasm for the pain of these heroes was
I so love great. Bobby Heenan on this show. He was so great and never about himself.
Yes.
Never about making himself feel important.
Yep.
There is a spot later where they're talking about cauliflower ears. And Monsoon basically says, you don't even know what a cauliflower ear is. And I guarantee you, there are announcers today that would have to be the know-it-all and have to keep their cred that they know what a cauliflower ear is.
Mm.
Not Bobby Heenan. Bobby Heenan played dumb because Gorilla was making him look dumb.
It definitely, you are always aware that the announcers always kept that focus on the match itself. Everything that they were saying, they never strayed too far away from what was actually happening in the ring, and they always directed your attention either to the participants in the ring or the action in the ring at the time. Not even talking about future storylines all that much. Everything was focused on what was happening in there.
Then, after working over the shoulder for a number of minutes, the tables turn and Michaels runs at Jannetty and runs his shoulder into the post in the corner, allowing Jannetty to fire up, sends Michaels to the floor, and then gets onto the apron, reverses a vertical suplex, sending Michaels over the top to the floor. Sherry walks over, slaps Sean, and man, did Monsoon sell this. What a shot! What a shot! And Michaels is selling this as a gunshot. There's a back suplex by Jannetty for a two count, landing on the right shoulder. So he has adjusted his selling to the left here. Then Jannetty comes off the top, lands on his feet as Michaels moves. We get a number of near falls, including a DDT that the crowd bites on, ducks a super kick, and he hits Michaels with a super kick for another two count. The crowd is into all of these falls. Slingshot sends Michaels into the post, another two count, and then Michaels back elbows the referee and knocks him down. Jannetty holds Sean as Sherry comes in with her shoe, and you know what happens next. Sean ducks the shoe and Sherry clocks Jannetty. Heenan calls for Michaels to pile drive Sherry for her blatant disregard of loyalty to her man. And then Sean super kicks Jannetty right in front of Sherry and pins him in 14 minutes and 20 seconds, and the distraught Sherry runs to the back.
Mm-hmm.
This match got equal praise and criticism, Way. Some people felt this was a flat match that wasn't what it could have been. Other people thought it was a really good match. I thought the crowd was really into this match, and while I feel these two would have better matches, this was a good match.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I definitely thought I thought selling from both men was good. I will say I think the story they're trying to tell with Sherry here was a little lost. Maybe there was a little too many storylines going on. I was actually more interested in the Rockers breakup, but they had to kind of tell the story of Sherry on the sidelines as well. I'd assume that they would continue this feud to you know, greater heights. But this one, it's the finish too, you know, with Marty Jannetty holding Sean and then Sherry hitting Marty by accident. It just, it kind of made the good guys look a little too foolish, and it almost made you kind of want to cheer the bad guy because he outsmarted these two idiots again.
Afterwards, Gene Okerlund is backstage with Sherry, and Gene's getting upset. Sherry, damn it, settle down. And then Michaels confronts her. Jannetty attacks Michaels backstage, and clearly, on this day, this program was supposed to continue, and this was to go to WrestleMania. However, the next day, they had television tapings in San Jose, and Marty Jannetty, allegedly, was found asleep in the locker room, and they were very suspicious of whether he was on anything, and was fired as a result of this the very next day. And that would once again throw this program into a tailspin. Michaels would then immediately be linked with Tatanka, and that would be his WrestleMania program for that year in Las Vegas. But essentially, they tried to do this 2 years in a row at WrestleMania, and 2 years, Marty Jannetty wouldn't be around. However, Jannetty, in him and the Iron Sheik, are the ones that it was opportunity after opportunity. Jannetty would come back in May, surprise appearance on Raw, and beat Michaels for the title. They never gave up on this program, but it certainly, it got to a point where they eventually did move on, and Marty Jannetty, there's no disputing, never reached the potential that he should have been. To me, maybe not as big a star as Sean, but he should have been a player eventually.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I thought Marty, at his best, he was great.
Well, I think that's why they probably gave this guy so many chances, you know, was because he was so talented. And I think it was also because that breakup angle was so good that they always thought that there was money to be made from this. And, you know, I thought, while, you know, both guys looked very good, it was even clear from here that Sean is the more charismatic one with, at least by this point, the more interesting gimmick, one that could be updated to the 90s a lot better than probably, you know, the Midnight Rocker in Marty Jannetty, who held on to that mullet for a very long, long time.
He did. He tried to just clear the decade with that thing.
Yeah.
As he moved on. Then we had intermission for about 10 minutes and 10 seconds. Bam Bam Bigelow against the Big Boss Man. And the Boss Man was certainly scaling back. He would have his final appearance on WWF television after February, but ended up working sporadically throughout August with the company, but was definitely being phased out. And Boss Man came in with his right hand all taped up, and then Bigelow attacked him from behind, splashed him in the corner, and then Boss Man hit him with a bunch of punches on top, which Heenan noted he's reading him his rights. With his right hand, which was the high spot of the match from the announcer. Boss Man took a back body drop to the floor, and then Bigelow worked over the back and worked over the back. Monsoon noted this is very surprising that he would target the back after this injury because Bam Bam is not a bright guy. Then we got a long, long reverse bear hug by Bigelow, putting the crowd to sleep. Helen looked so bored during this. Echoing my thoughts, constantly turning her head just to talk to Stu during this match. There's a mid-ring cross body. The Boss Man ducked. Let's just skip to the finish. Bigelow got his boot up in the corner, hit him with a clothesline and the diving headbutt to end this atrocious match that was the easy low point of the show for me.
Definitely. It was very slow and very plodding. It was sort of a match that you would expect from two heavyweights in the WWF in the late 80s, early 90s.
But these are two guys that are regarded as two of the better big men out there.
Probably against smaller, more capable opponents, though, than each other. You know what I mean? This was maybe a clash of two people that were maybe a little too similar. It was very slow, very plodding, and the long rest holds between the two. It was a bad recipe.
Yes, of course. This was also after the Nails feud with Big Boss Man. So this was kind of a working towards his end with the company. Then we moved on. They showed an angle from WWF Mania from 2 weeks ago where Owen Hart is being interviewed by Raymond Rougeau in Owen's his Zubaz pants and was attacked by Razor, who was choking Owen. And leading up to this match with Bret Hart, they show an interview with Razor from the night before inside the Arco Arena during a Sacramento Kings basketball game in this unbelievable gaudy shirt and bright red pants. I mean, there were some fashion choices in 1993 here.
Love it.
And then Gene Okerlund interviews Bret backstage. He says this is personal and Razor has crossed a line. This is not just another WWF title match.
Yeah, I thought Razor, to see him at this point, I just loved these old Razor Ramon promos, especially when he was a heel. I think he turned babyface, you know, it seemed rather quickly, and we were robbed of a lot more of these tremendous heel promos of him in full Tony Montana Scarface mode. I think everything about the gimmick at the time, the look, the music, the promos, everything was perfect. And it wasn't like it was that obvious of a ripoff of Scarface either. It was just a character that seemed highly influenced by him, and he kind of turned it into his own thing. And I have very fond memories, and as I'm sure everybody does, of the Razor Ramon character in this incarnation.
So that takes us to Bret and Razor Ramon for the title. Bret hands off his sunglasses to a young kid in the front row, and then Ramon throws his toothpick at the kid.
Yeah.
Awesome. Great. Ramon runs his left knee into the turnbuckle, and Hart immediately applies a figure four, gets the rope break, and he starts working over the knee, wraps it around the post, and then Ramon would connect with a knee to the ribs and just throw Bret ribs first into the post in the corner, and Bret Hart would then go on to put on a 18-minute clinic for Adrian Neville on how you sell the ribs in a match.
You mean Scott Hallwood? Or, yeah, Bret Hart.
Sorry. Well, yes. Bret Hart selling them himself. Yes. The match really could have used a 450 off the apron to the floor. That would have been awesome. There was a fall-away slam that Ramon hit, and they immediately cut to Helen, shielding her eyes from this awful man and what he is doing to her son.
She's great. She was the Izzy before Izzy in how much somebody's reactions added to the match.
Wow, that's some interesting thinking. What was that movie? The one where Brad Pitt descends in age. He's born old and then becomes
Benjamin Button.
Benjamin Button.
She's the Benjamin Button.
There you go.
Yeah.
Helen Hart and Izzy.
Yes.
It's a wonderful comparison. Mm-hmm. I cannot wait to review this WWE Kids pilot when it comes out.
Oh, me too. I can't wait.
Where Izzy does the post-match interviews.
And they have kids on commentary.
Yes.
Too, right? I can't wait for that.
They taped last week a Big Show against Heath Slater and Becky against Natalya. And then Izzy, apparently, like, one of her questions was, like, asking Bishop, like, what do you eat? I can't wait to watch this show. I will watch this every week.
Let's, instead of the first hour of Raw, let's review that instead.
I can't wait to see this pilot. Anyway, we continue on. The fans were just into everything that Bret did. I don't think this guy got enough credit for his popularity at this point. That was a down time for the WWF as a whole, and the fact that they were low on stars. I mean, Razor Ramon largely inherited this heel spot because of other extenuating circumstances. There was a back body drop that sent Ramon to the floor, and then Hart hit a suicide dive, which Heenan called just stupid, given the shape that Hart is in for his rib damage, and maybe corrupting the future wrestling psychologists.
I really liked Heenan and Monsoon together on this show and in this match, too. I found the two of them so funny. I thought they were the perfect comedian and straight man combo, and they would just get into the funniest arguments, but over, you know, their character's real logic. Heenan thinks Bret can't put the Razor into the sharpshooter because Razor's legs are too long. And Monsoon asks how Heenan would know that, or how Bret would know that if he didn't at least try. And Heenan just says, well, he's dumb. I just think that
they were so good. Like, they just,
so funny.
These were personalities unto themselves that were just, they worked off each other so well, especially in matches like this, where you just had the defined good guy and bad guy. Hart, with those awesome-looking punches during his comeback, they got into his traditional wear-down spots on Ramon, constantly going for covers, bulldog, reverse Russian leg sweep, tried for the sharpshooter, but in trying to counter it, rolled over Earl Hebner, taking him down to the mat, and Ramon broke free. He went back to attacking the ribs. That was always his go-to. Eventually goes for the razor's edge. Hart counters it by getting down to the mat into a backslide for a two count, and then Hart takes a Greco-Roman knuckle lock into a pin attempt. Ramon kicks out, and then their legs are intertwined. Hart crosses them off of his back and turns it into the sharpshooter, and Ramon taps at the 18-minute mark.
Yeah, you know, is pretty much a similar finish to the perfect match.
Yes, at SummerSlam.
Yeah, and overall, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say it was one of the more most memorable matches of either man's career, but I thought it was very good and certainly worthy of a semi-main event championship match. I thought technically both men were quite good. I mean, Brett, I think this was Brett, to me, at his in his prime in terms of popularity and also in terms of in-ring as well. And I was very impressed with Scott Hall here, able to work a body part very well and with a good amount of varied offense. It wasn't just punch, kick, same moves over and over. He had a variety of moves that I thought were fully used to tell the story here.
I thought it was a very well-worked match for someone like Scott Hall. He was limited, and they worked around what were his strengths and made him look very good in this particular match. So this was just a very well-put-together title match. I enjoyed it a lot, and Ramon was a very effective heel at this point when they needed them. And now we'll hear from Bret Hart and what the original plans were for this Royal Rumble and how he was going to get a big win over a major name.
Recently, you were on the WrestleMania podcast with Renee Young, and it was a very interesting story and unfortunate timing as well with his recent passing with the Ultimate Warrior that you two were actually scheduled at one point to be doing a pay-per-view together. I believe it would have been the Royal Rumble in 1993, and unfortunately just never came to pass. And that was such an interesting time period for you when they had just put the title on you, and that would have been quite the big program at the time, Bret Hart and the Ultimate Warrior.
Well, there was a lot of guys I should have and could have worked with back in those days. One of my big regrets is that I didn't work with Jake Roberts.
Yeah.
As far as I know, as I remember now, I don't think, as Vince McMahon used to always say, nothing was written in stone. But I know that I was, after I beat Roddy Piper at WrestleMania 8, I was tentatively scheduled to wrestle Jake the Snake at the SummerSlam the next summer, that summer coming up, but end up being in Wembley with Bulldog and all that instead. But Jake left the company after WrestleMania and they scratched that idea. So Jake was a great wrestler that I didn't quite get to work with. Say, if I'd had the good fortune of beating him at SummerSlam, that would have been a big win for me. And then, of course, I won the title a few months after Wembley, the world title. And I was told that it was going to be me and Warrior at the Rumble. And then again, it would have been another big opportunity to be in a big match and maybe get a big win over a big name in the business. And Warrior had some problems with his drug testing back then and left the company, and it never happened. And even then, a few months after that, I was set to, quite a few months later, I was supposed to work with Hulk Hogan at the SummerSlam, and that never came to happen. So I had a few missed opportunities there with some of the big names that would have been nice for me to have a chance to work with those guys, but it never happened.
Bobby Heenan then bolts from the announce desk because now it is time for the debut of Narcissus. And they cut to Heenan on the arena floor, unveiling Luger, surrounded by mirrors and a cape covering his body, and Bobby Heenan transformed into an MC at the Arnold Classic, drooling over this man's physique as Luger poses, and then Heenan interviews him. Luger notes how he is incredible and would use that word over and over and would be the most dominant force that the WWF has ever seen. It says he is one of the most mesomorphically magnificent athletes. Mesomorphically magnificent athletes. And just goes over and over, talking about himself, cuts a promo on Mr. Perfect, and then the curtains are coming down, and Bobby Heenan like gets onto his knees to see more of this man. I mean, it was just what a show this was for the debut of Lex Luger, who I can't say there was a more flat character that this felt like, but that Bobby Heenan was just adamant of getting over.
Heenan was like definitely kind of straddling the line between like maybe creepy and comical, and
he was on that line, dude.
He was very, but I found him just so entertaining, you know. I try to imagine the direction that Vince must have given him for this segment. Okay, Bobby, I want you to have an orgasm on air over this man's body, and I think Heenan certainly delivered.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, feast your eyes on that man. Look at the muscle mass. Look at the biceps. Look at the chest. Look at the abdominal region. Look at the thighs. Oh, yes. You are in love with yourself, and you have every right to be. You are the narcissist. You are the greatest creature. Gifted. You are gifted. There's the only thing I can say. Oh, yes. Look at that. Look at that. Look at that. Oh, my God. Most muscular. Oh, eat your heart out. Ladies, do you like what you see? Do you like what you see?
Like, this is probably Vince's dialogue in his head when the latest musclehead walks into his office.
No doubt. But how jarring would this have been to a WCW viewer who is familiar with Luger's run, and all of a sudden having him being introduced not by name, but under this Narcissus moniker and in a character that was very different.
Yeah, and for the timeline of this, I mean, Luger had wrapped up over a year prior to this with WCW and actually went to the WBF. He was going to be their main guy in the World Bodybuilding Federation. Then he had that motorcycle accident, and by the time he healed, the WBF was gone, and then they shifted him over to the World Wrestling Federation. And yeah, putting that WWF stamp, it's not Lex Luger, he's not coming in as that. He's coming in as Narcissus. And then that would mature into the Narcissist before they said, fuck it, he's Lex Luger. He's our new Hogan. Mm-hmm.
So Heenan here dropped some lines, and Heenan at the time was kind of siding with Flair, and so he feuded with Perfect and kind of dropped hints of that program.
Which would be the WrestleMania program for him. Mm-hmm. So I can't say, I mean, Bobby Heenan, 10 out of 10
yep.
in terms of his performance, but this almost felt to me like when Paul Heyman introduced Curtis Axel as his new protege, and it was just, you were taking a guy that everyone saw as credible and the main manager, and it's like, this guy can get anybody over. And I just felt with Luger, I watched this, and I was like, this is a dead character.
Yeah.
We'll see how long it lasts. And very similar, in a way, to Shawn Michaels, who had the mirror gimmick at this point as well.
Yeah.
I mean, there were a lot of similarities there.
Or the model Rick Martel.
Sure.
Yeah. There are a few of these, but it just, I think these one-dimensional characters had only so much of a lifespan.
What's my gimmick, Vince? Your body. You love yourself.
Look at you.
Look at yourself.
Look at those muscles. Look at those thighs.
Oh, my God. No, more. More.
Should have been Vince doing this.
Oh, God. Could you have imagined it? Look at him. Then we had Julius Caesar and Cleopatra themselves come out to the arena, accompanied by Roman soldiers, including a young Louis Spicoli, dressed as one of these Roman soldiers.
Interesting.
As Gorilla Monsoon plugs Las Vegas as the family entertainment capital of the world, which was fitting because this entire segment felt like it was purchased by a travel agency from the Nevada State Tourism Board. As fans appeared to hate this during Caesar's speech, referring to Caesar's palace as splendiferous. I was waiting for him to say the metamorphically splendiferous Caesar's palace.
Yeah.
And that was our kickoff to the road to WrestleMania and the world's largest toga party that year.
This took up a lot of time in the middle of the show, and I appreciate, first of all, the buffer between the matchups as well as the Rumble. It kind of gave a sense of anticipation to the Rumble. I appreciated that. But maybe it seemed to drag a little long, especially when you had the long Narcissus program right before it. I think at the time, people watching wrestling would probably hated this. But in hindsight, like, to watch it now, I mean, I think this campy stuff is just like part of the charm of watching these old shows. This is like, it's so stupid. You know?
So the Royal Rumble, there are years where they shave off time and they're kind of, it's all over the place. This was a year that up until the end, I mean, they were not only hard on the 2 minute entries, there were times it went over 2 minutes. And I'll say, way, there are years where we do not have to have 2 minute intervals. Yep. I mean, this was a long match.
There were certain parts that certainly dragged, yeah.
Not a roster that you can just populate with big spots. And it kicked off with Ric Flair, who won the prior year's Rumble, coming in at number three. This year, number one, and this was on the eve of his Loser Leaves WWF match, which he, of course, would lose to Kurt Hennig and return to WCW. So he was yet another name on the way out. And the guy who would join him to start this match, Bob Backlund,
yeah,
both in red trunks to start this.
They should have called each other.
This was, I mean, if you were a fan, like, say, us at this time and had grown up throughout the late 70s into the 80s. I mean, here is the long-standing WWF champion and a guy that was the NWA champion of the 80s. Mm-hmm. So a unique pairing in a WWF ring for those that had been longer-term fans.
You also had Jerry Lawler come in here.
You had a lot of interesting interactions here, mm-hmm, by guys with interesting backgrounds.
Yeah. Bob Backlund was on his comeback at this time, but he was just doing a babyface gimmick. But he was also like,
he was just a squeaky clean babyface,
like clean to the point that he was like a creepy uncle. You know what I mean? Like you would think that,
what a state of things, that just a pleasant man.
No,
it's just, oh, he's too
weird.
Nice.
He was weird, and here I don't know if it was intentional or not, but like he would kind of do his jig and all that stuff.
The shuffle,
and you would just like, you would think that there was something wrong with this guy. Nobody's this nice, you know. Like if Sage Northcutt wasn't as good looking,
he needs that shuffle.
I would think that there was something really seriously crazy about this guy. But Bob Backlund, you know, at this time, maybe closer to middle age and looked like a man out of his time for sure amongst this roster. This guy looks like a dad, and he was portrayed as such. But he came across like a little creepy, so that when he did turn heel, it wasn't a big stretch at all.
The funniest part of this was from the get-go. The constant line they always used was the fact that Bob Backlund is doing this at the age of 43. He's 43 years old. He is actually 5 months younger than Ric Flair. So Flair and Backlund, I mean, Flair was about to turn 44, like a month later. So it was just funny that they're both starting and Backlund is considered this aging vet, yeah, against the guy who's actually older than him, who did this a year ago.
That's interesting.
So
it's interesting.
That's where we were here to start things off. And how do you follow up former NWA champion numerous times, former WWF champion, number three, Papa Shango, who came in, who was actually injured at this time and was immediately dumped out. And Heenan is picking up right where he left off last year as Ric Flair's cheerleader. Ted DiBiase was in next. He helps Flair. Backlund gets referred to as Opie by Bobby Heenan, and for the second time on this show, Gorilla Monsoon threatens to knock Bobby Heenan out. I'm going to knock you out. These just angry old men. Brian Knobbs was in fifth, followed by VIRGIL, Where's My Fuck Money Virgil, who was in number six.
Is he cooled off on that?
I don't know. I can't say. Virgil.
I stopped following him.
He was a unique account for 15 minutes. Yeah. And then you kind of, once you see behind the curtain, it's, oh, okay, we got it.
Okay.
Fights with DiBiase. Knobbs is then running away. We're not going to go through all of this. Jerry Lawler was then in seventh, who had just debuted in the WWF. And again, if you are just a WWF viewer, He's just another entry here.
Yeah.
But if you're a wrestling fan, I mean, you got Backlund, Flair, and Lawler, and DiBiase.
Jerry Lawler was actually announced as by Bobby Heenan as the host of Superstars. Jerry
Lawler. Course. That's, you know, Jerry Lawler's claim to fame.
Exactly. But they certainly didn't necessarily try to promote the fact that any of these guys had careers prior to the WWE.
Okay. Then we get Max Moon, a.k.a. Conan.
Amazing. The cyborg once known as Conan.
Then Jinichiro Tenryu, who is introduced as the Japanese champion, and he exchanged in a battle of chops with Flair, to which Heenan notes, where do you think they get the term chop suey from? Followed by Kurt Hennig. I can't believe, Wade, that in this match we have Flair, we have Backlund, we have DiBiase, we have Jerry Lawler, Tenryu, Conan, and Kurt Hennig. I mean, Conan in Mexico, the biggest star in the early 90s, Tenryu in Japan, and I feel in WWF, they went to the lengths to, like, just forget everything, that the importance of some of these people who are all in the ring at once.
Which is why I have such little faith in what they're going to do with Shinsuke Nakamura.
Oh, he's going to come out to chop suey, System of a Down.
The track record for the WWE in handling talent that had made their name elsewhere isn't necessarily great, and I think this is a perfect example of that. I mean, to watch this as a just like maybe a knowledgeable wrestling fan, there are a lot of dream scenarios here. Max Moon and Ric Flair, I never thought I'd see that on this show, but really cool. But if you're just watching, probably, you know, as a WWE viewer at the time, you wouldn't think that there was anything special at all about these pairings.
Like, people go back and look at Flair, it's like he had an 18-month run in the WWF. Why did he go back to WCW? It was like Vince McMahon had cooled off on Flair by 18 months in. Where do you think Flair would have been in the WWF 2 years after this? His career got years added on to it because of going back to WCW.
Sure.
I don't think he would have lasted in WWF much longer than this. And he saw the writing on the wall. Mm-hmm. He knew he was being phased down at this point.
Yeah.
I mean,
I can't imagine what Flair would have done in the Attitude Era. You know what I mean? Aside from like a manager role.
He probably would have got a wacky gimmick in 95.
Yeah.
And probably would have been they would have wanted him in a road agent role by 95, 96. Mm. I really believe that. Perfect was in 10th and got a huge pop as he sprinted in and going immediately after Ric Flair. He would toss Flair over the top and eliminate him with, that would come a few minutes later, but he essentially eye gouged Flair over the top to the floor, and huge reaction for the elimination. One of the biggest reactions on the show, as Heenan was just deflated by his guy being eliminated.
Up until this point, Perfect was certainly the biggest babyface to enter the Rumble, and he had a lot of momentum behind him that I don't necessarily remember him like building off of all that much coming off of this feud.
It was funny because Perfect was, I mean, when Warrior was out, Perfect was the guy who came back, and then Perfect was the guy to take Ric Flair out, and he was set up as just there to put Luger over at WrestleMania. I mean, it was. Then he got the Michaels program, and then after that, that was kind of it for Mr. Perfect, who had kind of an uneventful return at a time when they were desperate for guys. Mm-hmm. Then we had Skinner and Coco Beware enter. This was high-energy Coco Beware with some of the goofiest-looking the MC Hammer pants with, like, the checkered flags on them because they were fast.
Heenan asked if somebody called a taxi upon Coco Beware's entrance.
Boy. Samu was entered at 13th with Offa taking him to the ring by his hair and throwing him in. This gave credence to Vince's comment recently that Roman Reigns was one generation away from a bone through his nose. That's kind of true. We're going to 93, where here are the hard-headed Samoans that eat raw fish. The Berserker was in 14th, John Nord. Perfect, then back body drops Jerry Lawler out, and that was Jerry Lawler's first Royal Rumble appearance. In and out in about 10 minutes. DiBiase, Coco, and Lawler all work to eliminate Mr. Perfect, who was protected on this elimination where it took everybody, and then he finally let go. But kind of uneventful, and I think Perfect would have helped this Rumble a lot to be in there a lot longer than he was. This was not a work rate heavy Rumble.
Yeah, but I noticed, you know, in this particular Rumble, they were certainly sectioning off different sections of it to tell the stories of a particular babyface or a heel. And I think Perfect was eliminated so that Taker...
He wouldn't be there for the Taker stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just look at the Backlund role of getting that 60 minutes. Oh, yeah. Like, that's a storyline unto itself where you don't win the Rumble, but you come out ahead when you get that spot.
Yeah.
Was Backlund the best guy for that? Physically, he could do it.
I'm not sure what their plans were with Backlund.
He lost to Razor at Mania. That was
Did he have a match at Mania?
Yeah. Yeah, he lost to Razor Ramon in just a pretty basic nothing match.
Yeah.
That was what they set him up for. So The Undertaker's out 15th, halfway through. Big reaction for him. Does eliminate Samu, eliminates Tenryu, and how about that? Taker, with his anniversary coming within a week of Tenryu's retirement show. And here is their interaction on this particular
Amazing.
Show. Tying it into today. Out 16th was terrific Terry Taylor, and he was not that terrific in this. Taker hit a chokeslam and clothesline DiBiase out, and DiBiase had prior dumped out Coco and Taylor within about 30 seconds of Taylor's entrance. And then we get the appearance of Giant Gonzalez, El Gigante, with Harvey Whippleman. And the announcers sell him as a monster, asking, what is that?
Yeah. This was the debut.
Heenan at one point said he could be 20 feet tall. 20. To which even Monsoon, not a man that shies away from hyperbole, cautions Heenan and says, I think 8 feet would be more appropriate than 20, Bobby. Taker is instantly attacked, and Berserker is eliminated, leaving those two. Damian Demento comes out during this. IRS comes out during this, and they are kind of just watching as Gonzalez chops Taker. Taker sells all over for this. He's chokeslammed, and then Gonzalez wraps the legs of Taker around the post. He just yells something crazy, something to the effect of Undertaker!
As this giant continues the onslaught on the Undertaker!
And that was all he said. This got a lot of heat from the crowd. Taker is struggling to sit up. And up until this point, like, Taker did not sell a whole hell of a lot, much less be the victim of a beatdown angle, and the announcers milked this for all it was worth, with Taker being manhandled, and Heenan adds that Harvey Whippleman promised to drop a bomb, and this bomb was so big that if they had did it to Hussein, there wouldn't be any trouble overseas.
Oh, my.
So Giant Gonzalez could have cured... or ended world violence.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
So Bobby Heenan, not one that was,
he did manage Adam Bomb a little later.
That is true.
You know, I don't know if I'm usually a fan of debuting important guys in the Rumble because I tend to think that they get lost, but I thought this was an awesome way to debut Giant Gonzalez and immediately set him up for a program with The Undertaker via the Rumble. I thought the surprise... the visual of seeing The Undertaker standing in the ring. I mean, you take several minutes in the Rumble to establish what a threat Taker is and what a giant he is by having him eliminate everybody. But then here's a guy who's even bigger than The Undertaker who quickly eliminates him. I thought this was done very well.
Yeah, and this would always be, as much as people look at the Taker WrestleMania matches, the Rumble was where he would always get killed in the 90s to set up his Mania program, whether it was this. The next year, he literally died after the casket match. In 95, his urn was stolen. 98, he was torched in the casket. I mean, the Rumble in the 90s was not favorable to one Undertaker. He died a few times at this event.
Bad time for him.
Yeah, but always the comeback at WrestleMania. So that took Taker, and in all of this, he was knocked over the top by Gonzalez to officially eliminate him and set up Taker's WrestleMania program. And this was probably the high point of the Taker Giant Gonzalez program was the angle and not so much the two pay-per-view matches they would have.
The angle was nice. Sad to say everything else about it that probably wasn't that great. I mean, just that...
this outfit, man.
Dude, exactly. That awful, weird bodysuit with the airbrush muscles and patches of, like, bad brown carpet all over his body. it's so bad. And I actually looked up if, like, is there, like, an action figure? Did somebody make an action figure? And certainly, yes, Jax made an action
figure. Oh, they did.
Of this atrocious Giant Gonzalez outfit, which I would love to have.
Well, maybe Agnew's listening to this. I'll take down some notes for next year with Blue Tista.
But, yeah, it's so bad, it's kind of awesome.
This is where the Rumble took a massive dive for me at this point, because we were left with, as we mentioned, Damian Demento, IRS. Backlund was attacked with a chair on the floor before all of this, so he's just dead on the floor during this whole point and is still in the match. Jerry Sags then enters, followed by Typhoon, who Heenan called Tugboat before he corrected himself. Very dull. This match brought to you by Stomps, Punches, and No Big Stars. Mm-hmm. Fatu entered. Earthquake entered. Then we had, this was the pickup for me, number 24 and one of the more well-remembered calls of Gorilla Monsoon's career for Carlos Colon, who came in and was identified as exhibiting a lot of fire in this youngster by Gorilla Monsoon, calling the 44-year-old Carlos Colon, who was older than the guy whose gimmick was he was the oldest guy out there in Bob Backlund. And Carlos Colon even got an elimination here for Damian Demento. Tito Santana came in. Then we had Rick Martel, who I will install the Body Oil Award to, because this guy, I mean, holy Christ, you wouldn't have been able to lift this guy. This guy had more oil on him than
GSP.
Than something that has a lot of oil on it. The fans were actually super into Bob Backlund by this late point when they realized, holy shit, Bob Backlund's still there.
Yeah.
This has been a long fucking time, which I think kind of went into how restless they probably were during some of this Rumble. However, the Royal Rumble, one of the things is, even a long Royal Rumble, it's a match that it starts and then they've automatically book 28 high spots.
Mm-hmm.
Every 2 minutes, it's just the ultimate ADD match, because every 2 minutes, they've got your interest.
Could be less than 2 minutes.
Some years, yeah.
Yeah.
So Martel was in, and they kind of teased the old Strikeforce feud between Santana and Martel. Earthquake ducked, and IRS was eliminated. And then number 27, the always coveted spot, was reserved for Yokozuna, along with Mr. Fuji. And Heenan proclaims that Fuji has been stuffing him with rice and sushi for a month now, bulking him up for this big match. Mm. Yoko tosses Tatanka out, knocks the youngster out. Then we got the stare down with Earthquake. This was our big, the immovable object against the unstoppable force.
The other immovable object.
Yes.
Yeah, it was interesting because Earthquake here is an actual former sumo.
Yes, which is not brought up in the commentary.
Well, it's not really a character.
Yeah, but they would have a sumo match on Raw. I think like a year later, they'd take the ropes down and they would play off that. Owen Hart was 28th, and this is when Earthquake hits Yoko with an avalanche, goes for another and misses, and Yoko struggles, but belly-to-bellies Earthquake over the top to the floor.
I can't imagine that would be easy, even if you're a guy as big as Yokozuna, to try to belly-to-belly suplex Earthquake from the ring to the floor. But Yokozuna definitely looked pretty gassed after this.
Yeah. Then the Repo Man was in there at the number 29 spot, and after that, it was, I think Gorilla thought this was the last entrant.
Yeah, he was.
Because then he had to kind of correct himself when we had yet another entrant, and it was number 30, Randy Savage, coming out, who was largely an announcer by this point as well. So yeah. The announced team for Superstars was well represented in this Rumble. Yoko tosses Santana out. Monsoon then proclaims, Backlund is still there. Owen Hart is still there. The difference was 53 more minutes that Backlund had been to Owen's 4. So I don't know if we had a real good comparable there to the length. I mean, Owen had come in number 28, as Randy had just come in at the 30th spot here. Owen dropkicks Jerry Sags out. Owen is then hip-tossed over and put out by future tag team champion partner Yokozuna. And then Sags and Repo Man are gone, and we're down to the final four of Yoko, Savage, Backlund, and Martel.
I think there might have been a bigger opportunity for Owens' elimination at the hands of Yokozuna to be a bit more memorable, considering the main event that they were heading into.
There should have been something. He should have injured Owen or done something that would have been a key spot that sets up the match to give Brett a reason later where he confronts Yoko. Mm-hmm. Instead of just being this dick that gets in the guy's face, give him a reason here. He cheap shots Owen. He hits him from behind. Something. Then Backlund knocks Martel off the ropes, and he's out. Backlund is hitting Yoko with a number of drop kicks, runs at Yoko, and Yoko sends Backlund over, and Backlund is eliminated after 61 minutes and 15 seconds, and the crowd legitimately boos this elimination. They believed Bob Backlund could pull this off and headline WrestleMania to get his WWF title that he never fairly lost with the towel being thrown in 83.
When they talk about, you know, impressive Royal Rumble performances, and especially ones that go over an hour, I rarely hear people bring up Bob Backlund. So I thought if their aim was to push this dude, they definitely succeeded very well by the end of this. Unfortunately, I don't really know to what gain, you know, this was.
That was it. I just didn't think you got a whole lot out of it. I mean, God, compare this to the performance of Flair the prior year, where I think it was a much more dynamic performance for 60-plus minutes. And yeah, you just didn't get a whole lot out of Backlund. And the only thing I can see is they wanted another guy to go this long. And let's be honest, on this roster, there probably weren't a whole lot of guys that could go this length. The best part of this elimination, though, is Yoko eliminating Backlund and yelling into the camera, Samoa!
Yeah.
And then yells it again, and they cut away. They're like, oh, shit, this guy isn't Samoan. He's not supposed to be.
He said that all the time. And, like, as a kid, I didn't know what he was really saying. I mean, I assumed it was Japanese. He got me.
Yeah. No, just his natural roots. He couldn't hold them down. This was Japanese.
I'm sure it's his way of you know, telling his family that, hey, I'm still Samoan.
I guess so.
Be like me screaming, Chinese.
As we try and depict you as what, a white individual?
Yes.
So it's down to Yoko and Randy Savage, and Savage is hitting him with all his offense punches, an axe handle off the top, trying to get him off of his feet. He runs into a super kick and takes a belly-to-belly and a leg drop. I mean, Yoko, very agile for a guy that was legit 500-plus pounds.
Yeah. His wobble is one of the greatest wobbles. You know, the tease that he would get knocked off of his feet. Because, like, the shape of his body was like, I mean, he looked like a guy just standing would be very unstable. And, you know, him, like, rotating his arms, like, doing the Matrix is just, I think he was fantastic at it.
Yeah, this was optimal. Listen, I'd never advise somebody to live their life at 500 pounds, but he could work at this weight. And it got unfortunate years later when he put on so much that he was immobile. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I mean, just so much bigger than this point. But man, yeah, the wobble. And when he finally, he hit Savage with the reverse hip attack into the corner, missed a second one, and staggers and falls down. And Savage hits the elbow drop, and then, man, you want to talk about a babyface looking dumb.
Yeah.
Savage goes for a pinfall that the announcers even have to say, like, what the fuck are you doing? And Yoko kicks out and propels Savage over the top to the floor.
Yeah.
I didn't know what this was. For a guy like Savage, who was ultra paranoid about how he came across, what a dumb way to look here, as Yoko eliminates him. 66 minutes and 40 seconds this Rumble goes, and Yokozuna wins the Royal Rumble to set up Brett and Yoko for WrestleMania 9.
I loved everything about the pairing of Yokozuna and Randy Savage up until the final 2 seconds, where I don't know why. I mean, I loved how they made Savage look like he was pretty much done, and then he had that desperation elbow drop. I think that was great, but for whatever reason, they made him go for a pin cover, and then the ridiculousness, even for a professional wrestling, of a man being able to body press from the ground another human body out from the floor to the outside over the ropes. it was a little too much for me.
It just looked so cartoonish, the way his chest landed on the ropes and just bounced up and over.
Yeah, so that was a little silly. But overall, I enjoyed the Rumble. Overall, I have to say, there was definitely a big 10, 12-minute lull right in the middle. And I attribute that maybe to a lack of depth. But overall, I thought there were easy to follow, nicely divided chapters within this hour-plus Rumble. You had the Flair story, the Flair Perfect story, you had the Taker story, and of course you had the Yokozuna story, all told within this compact hour match. I thought, you know, beyond the little slow spot, there was good action, good pacing, so I was satisfied by the end.
I thought that I wasn't as big a fan of the Rumble as you. I just think it suffered from the length of this. I think this was a perfect, and they would do this later, especially in 95. They'd really cut down on the entrances. I think this match in like 40 minutes would have been such a better Rumble. But it had its moments, and they worked with what they were dealing with, which was not a very bloated roster from a talent perspective and from, I mean, there were a lot of good performers that you had early in the Rumble, your Hennigs, your DiBiases, which really weren't relied upon all that much in this Rumble. But it made Yokozuna feel like a monster. Mm-hmm. You introduced a new guy in Gonzalez that, at least for this night, it was a big angle. You'd never seen The Undertaker destroyed like this, in this fashion. So you accomplished a lot, which is what the Royal Rumble should do. You knew what your top matches were for WrestleMania coming out of this. And an average Rumble, probably one of the more lower-tiered ones for me, but it accomplished certain goals that you needed. So overall, I had a fun time going back and watching this particular Rumble event. I give this show a 7 out of 10. I think it had its moments, certainly. I enjoyed the Michaels and Jannetty match, and the Rumble, it had its ups and downs, is what I'll say.
I liked the Rumble's Jannetty match. I liked Razor and Brett, and I enjoyed the Rumble. So, and of course, I think the MVP of this show is Bobby Heenan. He was just tremendous all show long.
Agreed.
I give it an 8 out of 10.
All right. At this point, we're going to go back and hear some comments from a 2010 interview that Dan Lavransky conducted with Marty Jannetty, discussing his relationship with Shawn Michaels and their feud, which truly never did reach its peak.
I want to talk about when the team broke up as well, because there seems to be some sort of strange story in with all of that in 91 too, with tell me if I'm wrong, but something about you going to McMahon for more money and then Shawn decided he didn't want to leave or something.
Well, that's bits and pieces of the actual thing. I mean, what actually we had sat with Vince and had a meeting about, we weren't necessarily saying we want more money, we were just saying we wanted a better position in the company. We'd been mid-card for
right
all that long.
Right.
You know, and we had said, you know, we're willing to do more work, whatever it takes to go to that next level, you know, and we would know if our paychecks reflected, you know, that we're moving up. You know, that's how, it wasn't like, yeah, give us more money. You know, I mean, because we straight up said we'll work twice as much, and hell, we was already working a lot.
Sure.
You know, we was working 275 yeah. times a year then. But out of that, then Shawn had got injured and he was off the road for a little bit. I think Shane Douglas, if you remember him, he
yep.
was filling in for Shawn, because Shawn, I think, had hurt his knee riding his motorcycle or something or other. Something I told him, don't do that, man, because all the guys get, you know, we could go through phases. One time it's cowboy boots, next year's motorcycles, and whatever it is, the cowboy hats, whatever it was, but everybody's getting motorcycles that kept getting hurt, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so Shawn, but he did anyway, and sure enough, that's the first time he hurt his knee. But so anyway, he was off the road for a while, and Shane and I were tagging, doing, you know, going around. He was filling in. We actually did a commercial in Atlanta, and it ended up where you signed SAG, Screen Actor Guild.
Yes, yes.
Papers or something other that for if you have words in a
right.
in a commercial.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't know to and Shawn had flown in. That was at the end of one of the tours. But Shawn flew up to do the commercial. It was a Superstar cereal. It was a cereal, you know, WWE or F.
Right.
But they gave us the sheet that signed for the SAG, and it had to pay on it. And everybody, Shawn was leaping through, and they just, you know, that's something they should have done. Hand it to the guys who would see where everybody's getting paid.
Yeah, really.
That was a big mistake there.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Sean's leafing through looking for ours, and when he finds it, he goes, holy shit, look at this. Everybody's getting twice as much as us. So I'm thinking, well, that's because there's two of us. We're a tag team, maybe. And he goes, no, look at the Road Warriors, or they were what they called Legion of Doom at that time. Look at, was it Typhoon? And, what were they, Natural Disaster?
Yeah, Natural, yeah, yeah.
So everybody, including the other teams, were getting twice as much as us. You know, and the truth of this was that Sean really got pissed off about it. He don't tell it that way, not in his book and not in his shoot interviews, but him and I talked about it recently. And, you know, yeah, he asked me, how do you remember all this? He got really upset that I actually did remember the truth, and he didn't deny it, but yet he still put it in his book a different way. So anyway, what that was he wanted to quit when he saw the pay. He wanted, that's it, we quit. We just talked to him about money, we talked about moving up the ladder, and he just, this is just an insult, let's quit. Well, my dumb ass back then didn't care. So I was like, okay. Went right over to the phone and called, and you know, Pat Patterson, if you remember him, he's actually the one that answered, and I said, hey, Sean, when did you talk to Vince? Well, Vince is busy right now. Can you call back? Yeah, so like, well, can you just let him know Sean and I are, we're going to put in our notice we're going to quit? Oh, Jesus Christ, hold on, Marty. And then Vince is on the next minute.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, I told him that we just wanted to. Back then, you had like a 90-day written, you get out of your contract, written call.
They still have that.
I asked him, you know, how do we do that? We haven't ever had to do that. Would we just write anything in particular? And he was like, well, what's the problem? You know, and to wrap up this long story, basically, I said, no, we just want to finish up. We've already talked about things, and it didn't look like it mattered, so we just want to finish up. No, that was, I knew there was a little bit of trouble when we hung up. And Sean was standing right next to me,
right.
You know, watching and listening to my words. And as soon as I hung up, and here was the good thing, I thought anyway. We're supposed to have 90 days, and you know what that's for. So they can beat you down for the next 90 days so you don't, product's not so much going into this wherever you might go.
Right, right.
The next thing we had was Survivor Series, which was 3 weeks away. And that was the next TV. And then he said, well, I'll let you finish up there. I don't want you to be where you're not happy, you know, which I thought was cool as hell.
Mm-hmm.
Only three, we had one TV to get beat on, and it's Survivor Series. Who cares, right?
Yeah.
But when I hung up, Sean was like, well, what'd he say? Yeah, so you ain't gonna believe it. Now I'm thinking I'm giving Sean good news. Like, he's gonna let us finish up the Survivor Series. But when Sean's face got pale white and his mouth hung open, and he goes, he's gonna let us fucking quit. I was like, uh-oh. Oh, shit. Sean, did you not just tell me to go over there and tell him we quit and stand right next to me and listen to him tell him, but he's gonna let us? Oh, boy. And I didn't think much of it. We flew home from Atlanta after the commercial shoot. I flew to Orlando. At that time, Sean was in Tampa. When I got home that afternoon, there was a message on my voice or answer machine from Vince McMahon saying, call the office. I'd like to talk to you right away. About 5:30, I think it was, because I remember thinking he's probably not in. So I called him, and he had mentioned something about, you know, welcome to stay and do singles. You don't have to quit. And I thought he was like going behind. I thought Vince was trying to, you know, split us up behind each other.
Right.
And I remember saying, no, we made this decision together. You know, Sean, I'm not going to go behind Sean's back, stabbing the back like that. Vince says, then he goes, well, that's very strange. He goes, I just talked to Sean. He said he had nothing to do with that decision. So I don't even know if I said goodbye. I hung up and called Sean about it. Said, you know, but tell me it ain't true what Vince just told me. And as it turned out, you know, Sean goes, well, Marty, look, you're on the flight home. I thought about it. I mean, I'm married. You're single. I mean, your house is paid off. I'm still paying. I can't afford to quit. But you just made me the bad guy. And that's the true story on that deal.
Right.
So, I mean, and you know, and Sean doesn't like to ever, you know, and I'm not trying to put Sean down now. I love him to death. But he'll it's hard to ever get him to admit when he's wrong, especially if anything that involves me.
Yeah.
And one of the wrestling matches we were at recently, he actually called me over, wanted to get this particular story straightened out, and called one of my buddies over to make sure I had a witness. And when I told him, he just got a little upset. He's like, I don't know how you, this was his actual words, how do you remember more than me? You did more drugs than I did.
Oh, wow. Very, that's an amazing story, Marty. Thanks for sharing that. Now, the sad part about all that is, unfortunately, is that you guys never got to do a real proper breakup of the team. You did that great segment with Brutus the Barber where Sean threw you through the window, and then that's it. It's unfortunate because that feud, I'm sure, would have made some big money.
Well, and that is something we did try several different times, and, yeah, there were, you know, a couple of times that I made some foolish decisions, and, you know, because I'm far from perfect. I made some mistakes that kind of put a halt to continuing the story. And there was another time, and I'm not going to say anything. I've already said enough about Sean, but it was another time somebody else did something that was very wrong that kind of ended it all. But they did attempt it several times.
Yeah, it is unfortunate, especially coming off that the barbershop segment, because you talk to a lot of older fans, everybody remembers that segment where, you know, you put them through the window and that. And everybody remembers that.
Yeah, I mean, even like when I go into dressing rooms today on the independents, you know, the younger guys that are just breaking in, they come up and tell me how that had such an impact on them. You know, they couldn't believe it. You know, they were 10 years old. They started crying when they saw it.
Yeah, well, that's it. It was such an amazing segment. And I remember as being a fan at the time going, you know, I was really disappointed because we never got to see that series of matches. You know, we never got to see the proper breakup of the Rockers.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe it could still happen one day.
From Marty Jannetty, we now go to the Law message board for your feedback to the 1993 Royal Rumble. Matt starts us off. El Gigante in a hairy bodysuit. I still burst out laughing when he appears. I watched WCW also in that era, so I knew there were no muscles, and he was just a rail-thin kid. The two positives on the Rumble were the Hart versus Razor match and the Beverly Brothers getting manhandled by the Steiners. The Steiners truly were 141.3% better than the Beverlys. The bad was the Luger debut. He went from narcissist to the narcissist to the narcissist Lex Luger before he even debuted, and by the summer would be made in the USA Lex Luger. Gives us a 6 out of 10.
Will there have been a better way to hide? I mean, surely, yeah, this man's, I guess, skinny body than a suit made of muscles.
I mean, you know, for the time, I mean,
what could he have done?
I mean, airbrushed muscles are
parachute pants.
That's true. He could have been part of high energy.
Yeah.
Maybe low energy. Mm. He probably gets tired at that size walking around all day.
Low energy. Although he is tall.
Yeah, you could have like a caution flag instead of the checkered flag.
Okay. All right. Alan Gaynor, not nearly as memorable as 92, but still, there was a lot to like about this Rumble. I feel the undercard of this edition was the best that they had presented up to this point. Previous years had been filled with some overly long bushwhackers and Jim Duggan matches, so it was nice to see some more athletic action. The most memorable part of this event for me were Bob Backlund's performance, which was surprising since he was used very sparingly on TV, both before this event and after, and the very good world title match. I was very shocked at the time when Yokozuna won. All he had really done up to this point was beat Virgil at Survivor Series. I figured Savage was winning it when it came down to those two. Oh, the days before the internet when genuine surprises like that could happen.
Danny from Calgary, Alberta. A few memories from this show. I watched this on pay-per-view when I was 10 years old. I really liked the Bret Hart Razor Ramon title match. I hated the way they introduced Lex Luger at this show. Why not just put him in the Royal Rumble match? The Rumble match wasn't bad this particular year. Nice to see Genichiro Tenryu in the match, even though you could hear a pin drop when he came out. I disagree on that. With Luger, I mean, it's what we always talk about, making a big debut, like you mentioned with Giant Gonzalez. Luger was not going to be winning this Rumble. Mm-hmm. So why are we going to put him in a situation where he fails, and that's our first impression?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, I don't think he belonged in the Rumble at all. And how about that up-and-coming 44-year-old youngster, Carlos Colon? I hated the way they introduced Giant Gonzalez in this match as a mysterious monster, because even at 10, I knew instantly it was El Gigante from WCW. I also hated when Gorilla Monsoon would say how long someone was in the match, and it was always embellished. It was not embellished, because I had my stopwatch, and he was pretty much dead on every single time. So that is not a fair strike to Gorilla Monsoon's commentary. I think that he said Flair and Backlund had been in for over 22 minutes at about the 15-minute mark of the match. I don't believe that is true. And a rare thumbs down to Randy Savage, who ruined the ending of the match by attempting a pinfall on Yokozuna. But overall, this match had one purpose. Get Yokozuna over as the indestructible monster going into WrestleMania, and they achieved that. And it even had Bill Alfonso as one of the referees. Thumbs in the middle show overall for me.
Go to Ronaldo from Milan. With kids' eyes back then, I was in awe of Giant Gonzalez destroying The Undertaker. As terrible as the wrestler was, Vince sure made all he could do with the guy and his size. Yoko winning the Rumble gave way to one of the best heel champions in wrestling and some of the best big man matches with Bret and Luger. Marty Jannetty never reached his full potential, and it's a shame because at his peak with HBK, the guy could go and be equal to Shawn. Too sad nowadays the guy is broke and can barely walk. All in all, a nice show that brings back a lot of memories. Razor Ramon was the true talent in the click and, like Jannetty, got the ball but did nothing with it.
Extenuating circumstances, but certainly Jannetty. I think he kind of left the ball on the doorstep, if you will. It was there, and he was under house arrest for a period of time, so he couldn't come and answer the door.
The ball rolled away.
I guess so, yes. Into oncoming traffic. Yeah. Chris in Ottawa, our fact checker. Gentlemen, always great to dive back into an early Rumble show. For my money, the IC title match was the most fun part of the event. Shawn Michaels in the early 90s bumped like Kurt Hennig on Fast Forward. If you ask me, Michaels was the most talented member of the clique. But I know that this opinion isn't shared by everyone. And I presume Bobby Heenan begging for Shawn to waffle Sherry was the first reason why the extra long network disclaimer appears at the beginning of the show. Damn it, Sherry, you are hysterical. Damn it, Mean Gene, you are hysterical. That was awesome. And just for good measure, an orange randomly flew at the camera out of nowhere during the Michaels Jannetty backstage melee. I did not notice that. Did you guys see that there was an actual Big Boss Man in uniform in the floor seats during Big Boss Man's ring entrance? Either that old cop was the first cosplayer in wrestling history, or that was the greatest coincidence ever. I did not catch that. Do you guys prefer Giant Gonzalez with fake fur or painted on fur? The whole thing's pretty weird. And he asks for a song request. I know the show doesn't end with a song very often anymore, but it's my birthday, so what the hell, could you play this classic that was at the top of the dance charts when the 93 Rumble occurred? I will say yes, because I recently added this song on my music playlist. It's Bizarre Inc.'s I'm Gonna Get You.
Oh my.
So we'll play that going out.
We go to McWhalen, who says, the Royal Rumble 1993 is, like most Rumbles, a one-match show. However, that match would be Razor versus Bret instead of the Rumble itself. I always got a kick out of the Beverly Brothers, and the Rockers' Intercontinental title match was okay, but not as good as their Raw match where Marty won the belt. The Rumble itself was very pedestrian, with the only memorable moments being Bob Backlund winning the unlikeliest Rumble Iron Man ever contest, Giant Gonzalez appearing, and the Macho Man going for the pin on Yokozuna in a Rumble match. 5 out of 10.
Next up is Sean in Calgary. If Bobby Heenan was ever to be accused of any kind of criminal behavior involving inappropriateness, all the prosecutor would have to do is play that Lex Luger intro video and he'd get an instant conviction. Very average show. I'll give it 5 awkward Bob Backlund rest holds out of 10. If listeners want to send Tim Hortons gift cards as a token of our appreciation, where should we send them? I'm not going to discourage this. If you want to send it to us. Where can they send it? Just email us?
Yeah.
I don't want to be one of those people.
No, I don't want to either. I don't want to either.
On the other hand, we're not asking for this, but I'm not going to discourage it.
But should we encourage it?
I'm just going to say, if you ever want to contact us, way@fightnetwork.com, john@fightnetwork.com.
Those are no longer our emails.
They still work, though. It's probably easiest.
Yeah, what if people listen to this like years down the line? We should give them our personal emails.
I'm not going to do that. But those emails are probably the best. Hey, if you just want to say we enjoy the show, you can use that particular inbox.
Fine.
I spent a lot of time having to watch all these shows every week.
All right, yes, we need a lot of coffee.
I need to get through this way. Let's go to... Oh, that was me, so you're up next.
We go to Jesse from the 6. Why did the actor portraying Julius Caesar recite lines said by Mark Anthony? I hope somebody got fired for that blunder.
They did not, nor did anyone probably care.
A few questions. Why did it take them so long to pay off the Michaels-Jannetty feud? They broke up over a year before this, and Michaels spent half.
That was it. In between firings.
At this point, did Vince know that he wanted the title back on Hogan by the end of WrestleMania, or was that to be determined?
I don't know when they officially made the call that Hogan was going to get the title. From my recollection, it was closer to WrestleMania. I don't feel they knew it at this point. And the plan was Hart would lose to Yoko, Yoko loses to Hogan, and this would set up Brett beating Hogan at SummerSlam. That's how it was pitched to Brett.
No mention whatsoever of Hulk Hogan on the show.
No, he'd be back on television a few weeks after this on Raw, which really sparked Raw to become the go-to show when they did the angle taking out Brutus Beefcake, and then Hogan came in for the save to set up the tag match with Money Incorporated. And we were not getting Raw at this time, and I was just so frustrated as a fan. I was like, this is clearly a more important show than Superstars, and I can't watch it. Final one is Kevin from Sasquatchland. I don't know if that's a play on Saskatchewan or not.
Sasquatchland.
I remember 1993 fondly, since this is the year I began watching wrestling. Nostalgia was strong in this show. Watching Bret Hart versus Razor Ramon showed how much the Fed had in terms of confidence with Razor so early into his run. Yokozuna was a bit, if a letdown, considering...
A bit of a letdown, considering
as a 7-year-old, a heel winning the Rumble killed my evening. I'm just glad my homework was already done before the show started. Booyah, Mrs. Noble. 6 out of 10 Japanese salt throws. Well, as we said, this was an afternoon card, so I mean, you would have had more than enough time Sunday night to finish homework afterwards.
I hope you got a good mark. Yes. This is Noble.
This was a show as well that, I mean, this was Scramble Vision era for me.
Oh, me too.
So, I mean,
this was probably Black Box era.
Yeah. I mean, oh, you lucky fucker. Yeah. So you got to see it probably.
No, actually, I didn't. I did watch WrestleMania 9. I don't necessarily remember watching this back then.
Man, I remember that, you know, you'd go to the Rogers video, and it would take probably 2 to 3 months for this video to show up after it had aired on pay-per-view. So I'd listen to it, but I was just dying to see it.
You listened to the whole thing? Like all 3 hours?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You certainly deserved this.
I wouldn't be watching it. My mom always thought it was just so weird, and she was like, well, don't watch it. It's going to hurt your eyesight.
Dude, it would drive me nuts like to listen to it and not be able to see it.
It drove me nuts, too, but I was like, the alternative is missing this and not knowing what happened. I had to know what happened. But man, when I would go into that video store 3 months later and saw the case for the latest pay-per-view, first of all, just the case being there would be big, and then you'd have to have the empty case behind it to signal that it's available.
Right.
Man.
And was it always available? You were probably the first one there.
There were times the new one was not there, and it's like I would just be so disappointed if I got there it wasn't there. But all week long, you'd wait to go to when the new releases came out.
Did you ever ask your parents to get pay-per-view? Was it even available at the time?
It was always something. It was never something.
Oh, it must have been if you got scrambled.
I believe that it was just so complicated to get pay-per-view. Yeah. I just didn't know. It's like, how do you even get this?
You got a call? I got to give my credit card?
You had to get a box and everything, and it was just... I didn't think my parents were really into it, but I remember once that, like, you would go to the... They had a section where it was, like, 8 or 9 wrestling tapes of the latest ones.
Next to the adult videos?
Yeah. The place I went, actually, they didn't put the wrestling ones there for whatever reason. But you would exhaust these 9 tapes. Like, every time I'd go to the video store, it was just renting another one. And then there was one day I was there, and they had the cart where they're putting back videos that had just been returned from the bin. And I saw a hardcover of WrestleMania 7, which is, it's like, that's a time frame that these videos are all, like, 93... 92 WWF videos. This is 91. And so I'm watching as he's filing these, and he takes the WrestleMania 7 video and puts it in this other area. I was like, he didn't put it in the wrestling section.
What?
So I followed, and I go look. Way, my jaw nearly dropped. There was a second wrestling section in the video store, and there were like 30 wrestling tapes I have not seen. And for a 9-year-old... Dude, I was like...
You must have sounded like Bobby Heenan in this. Like... Narcissus.
Like, I was like, whoa, take a walk, take a walk, take a walk. I was in wrestling heaven as a 9-year-old, wow. realizing that the next year of my life was built around every time my dad would take me to the video store and I could rent one movie, this is what I'm going to be getting. And it had tapes going back to, God, they had WrestleMania 2. It was like 80s, 90s. I hadn't seen any of this stuff.
Mm. Wow. Did they have not just WWF, but WCW?
They had like one. It was like the Chi-Town Rumble with Flair and Steamboat.
Do you think that was only because of our area? Like, I wonder if it was like Charlotte, for instance, that it would be different if they'd have more WCW tapes.
I'm sure. Like, a lot of those video stores, you could actually fill out requests and stuff of like what people wanted. And I mean, wrestling's pretty damn fringe. Yeah. So the WWF was kind of the go-to that they would get the newest release for. And WCW, I mean, eventually over the years, there would be more WCW available, but I always remember they were very few and far between.
Mm-hmm. I would love like a Wonder Years starring John Pollock. And it would just be your discovery of like things like this, you know, your path towards professional wrestling. And we'd have a Daniel Stern voiceover, like.
Yeah, you need someone wrestling related to be my inner monologue. Yeah. Maybe it would be.
Who could it be?
Gene Okerlund.
Sure.
No.
He doesn't sound like that.
I don't know who fits. Bob Backlund.
Somebody with a nice voice. But
wow.
Oh, yes, it would be Brett. It would be Vince. But, man, that's a wonderful story. I love that.
That's my wrestling tape story for the day. Okay, this is how we're going to end the show. We're going to go out with Bizarre Inc., and after the music ends, I'm going to insert the conversation we had earlier in this show, which has been taken out, on our Making a Murderer discussion.
Oh, you're actually going to
I'm taking it out. I'm going to perform surgery on this show. We talked about it for, like, 5 minutes. And I'm going to tack it on at the end so nobody can complain that the Making a Murderer conversation is at the end of the show, just like it was at the end of Review of Raw.
We didn't even announce what we're doing.
That's what we're going to do now. Next week, we're going to review one more Rumble this year because we are a week away from this year's version. And what year have we chosen?
We looked at the list of all the shows that we haven't done yet, and there are a number of them. But the one that I suppose was the least offensive, and the one that I was looking forward to the most, is 1998. We are going to stay in the 90s, but
an Undertaker death year.
Not a good year for the Undertaker.
Or Shawn Michaels, as it would turn out.
Yeah, so right, pretty much. I mean, I felt this show was sort of on the cusp of the transition to the new generation era. Well, we're going to head to 98 on the cusp of another transition to a different era.
And we're going to stick in kind of the same area. This show is in Sacramento. We're going to San Jose.
Oh, wow. Okay.
For this particular card. I bet you Dave Meltzer was at this show in 98. He was at this one in 93.
Wow.
So cool. There you go. Next week, the 1998 Royal Rumble. We were originally going to do the 2009 one, and I feel that one would have been panned by people for our selection. However, I mean, there's only so many Rumbles out there, everyone.
Yeah,
we are not going to get into the habit of re-reviewing Rumbles. So at some point,
I'm not doing that.
We're going to be getting to more obscure Rumbles. It's just going to happen. I think those are fine. I think
re-review?
No. I mean, even if it's a lackluster Rumble event, there are always a million gems in these shows that you can dissect from. But next week is 1998 from San Jose, California, the year the WWF truly exploded, going into WrestleMania 14 that year. So that's our review coming up next week. And I want to alert everyone to go to liveaudiowrestling.com. We have a 3-hour edition of The Law. It was so big, we couldn't even fit Wei Ting into it with our worst of 2015 picks, as well as extensive coverage of all the big news from the past week. Dave Meltzer stopping by. Monday, we've got Review of Raw, which is up and you can download and watch at youtube.com/Fight Network, as well as Dan Lavransky's special, Victory or Die, as he looks back at the life and career of Lemmy and some of the classic and more obscure Motorhead tracks. That is up, an audio special that Dan Lavransky put together on Lemmy that you can download for free up at the website and on iTunes and Stitcher.
And we still have time, or you still have time, to enter our annual Royal Rumble pool.
That's right, royalrumble.info. You have until next weekend to join before the Royal Rumble. Should go back to Do we know the deadline? I believe it is the night before.
Just do it now.
I think everyone should submit it by by the Saturday,
no,
which would be January 23rd.
Let's not even tell them the deadline.
Okay,
if you miss it, then you fucked up.
We already have over 100 entries.
So you better do it
now. This is going to be a big one this year. Yeah. So royalrumble.info, it's free to join. There will be a prize for the winner. And I have to run this by you, Wei. Coming out of the Rumble, I have a contest idea.
Okay, run it by me.
Okay, well, I'll do this after, because you might just scoff at it.
What?
I don't want to get a Royal Rumble 2009 reaction from you, where you think, what else is there?
Yeah. All right.
This has been a lengthy show. Thank you to Marty Jannetty for talking to us 5.5 years ago. Thank you to Bret Hart, who is always great whenever he comes on. And for you listening, and we'll chat with you later on this week. Goodbye. Here is some Bizarre Ink. We were originally going to talk about Making a Murder on this show. However, we decided on Monday to do it at the end of Review of Raw to avoid anybody being upset about spoilers and give them plenty of warning ahead of time at the start of Review of Raw. Have you changed any of your thoughts since Monday's discussion about this show that you and I marathoned over the weekend?
No, I don't think so. It's almost like I haven't had that much time to reconsider. But it's a little weird. You know, the topic of spoilers for what was a real life event. You know what I mean? I guess it was kind of like...
To me, it's like anyone that gets too upset about that, it's like, listen, this story, they were sentenced in 2007.
Yeah.
This is nearly a decade old story.
You actually kind of spoiled it right there.
Oh, yeah. I'll have to censor that. I'm going to write that down, actually, because whenever I think of censoring stuff, I always forget it. So here we go. 1430 mark. I need to write this stuff down because I'm really bad at remembering this stuff.
It's fine. It's fine. Anyway.
Wait, come on. Your phone.
Sorry. Okay.
My one
point. What do you have to add to the discussion we've
just the
had?
Fact that I feel people really overlook the fact that the whole wrestling tie-in to this.
Oh, yes.
Like, if I was the defense for Brendan Dassey, I don't care how deep I go into spoilers here. I'm going to try and keep it vague. But listen, this is a guy that was a massive wrestling fan.
Seemed like it.
Seemed like it.
Yeah.
He's in prison with his mother. And what is he thinking about?
He's in prison on the phone with his mother.
On the phone with his mother.
His mother's not there.
Facing perhaps life in prison. And what is he thinking about?
WrestleMania.
WrestleMania 22 in 2006. That's a priority. It tells me he is a massive wrestling fan. And he gets the date wrong by not a day. He got it off by 8 days. By 8 days,
yeah,
he got it wrong.
I know.
So already, I'm concerned about his credibility and his ability to piece together anything on top of that. Yeah.
As far as this is to even stop you. As far as I know, you're the only person to identify this. I mean, there have been a lot of discussions coming out of this documentary series on Netflix. A lot of people pointing out the omission of certain facts and the omission of certain details. But you're the first to uncover this very staggering inconsistency in Brendan Dassey's, not necessarily.
Listen, if that Lieutenant Lenk
is called on by the defense attorney for the fact that when he checked in to the site of the vehicle being found, that he was off by a couple of hours. As the defense said, jury, we're not talking about a few hours, 15 minutes. We're talking about the difference between broad daylight and darkness at night.
I believe he's going to go back to trial, isn't he?
Is he?
I heard he has.
I literally finished this, and I've not read a ton.
I think I knew on Monday, but I forget now.
Okay. Well, that's very good. The second thing, everyone looks at the date of Teresa Halbach's murder was on Halloween. It was a Monday night way.
Okay.
So I believe that Brendan Dassey has an alibi out there that he has not exercised. I'm sure him and his brother were watching Raw that night when they were doing the quick angles to set up Taboo Tuesday the following night in 2005.
I think you should maybe write in to the defense team of Brendan Dassey, and this could open up a whole new case.
I think wrestling could set Brendan Dassey free.
Season 2, I think, of this show. I think we have a new storyline, a new hook.
Brendan Dassey has lost his ability to have an attorney. And he brings on you and me as the new defense.
You know, we'll just all base it around pro wrestling.
Yes. It was actually, do you remember the night that Vader showed up on Raw and tumbled on the ground?
No, vaguely. Vaguely.
Oh, this was he ran down and he just fell, bouncing off.
Yeah.
That was the night of the murder on Monday, October 31st.
Wow.
So okay. I would be curious. That would be my first question. Brendan Dassey, do you remember this moment? And if he says yes, that clearly means he was watching Raw.
We know.
And couldn't have been helping dispose of a body.
True, but we also know this guy will probably say yes to anything.
That's true. And that's why I think you have to throw out. I mean, no DNA. No bloodway.
All right. Enough.
I might take this out and put this all at the end of the show. I'm worried now about the backlash.
No.
Because as much as I talk about spoilers, I did not want to have the show ruined. And yeah. I had to leave numerous conversations last week. And that was the big impetus was that, listen, I'm going nuts here at work by everybody talking about this. I want to watch this show. I need to get this done. And when you said you marathon through it, I was like, okay, now I have a reason to finish this because I can talk about it. I found now with Show's Way, I need something at the end of this. I don't want to just watch a whole show
and then
eject it from my brain. I need to get it out on a show.
So basically anything you want to watch, you got to let me know so we can both
exactly.
Watch it.
I'm very vain. I need to watch something and let the world know about my opinions.
The people care about your opinion, though.
I don't know about this stuff, but I also watched Creed. I loved it.
Oh, good.
Very good. Very good movie. We won't talk about that either. We got to wait 40 fucking years.
Sylvester Stallone won Best Supporting Actor, though.
I haven't seen the Golden Globes.
Oh, shit,
I'm kidding. This is what people are like.
No.
Do you know how many people have tweeted me over the last week about their thoughts on spoilers? I've become the poster boy for this spoiler movement, this non-spoiler movement.
You've been one of the more outspoken people, I would say.
Good for Sylvester Stallone. He deserved it. He was excellent in this movie.
He was very good.
He was great. And Michael B. Jordan was awesome.
Yeah.
And Stitch Duran has like a real role in this movie.
Well,
he gets to say something. He gets to say, rock, and pass him the phone. I mean, that's the difference between a giant pay scale by saying a word in a movie.
That is true. Not that he'd be up for any type of award, nor other movie roles.
Best cut man.
Yeah, sure. He played himself, which is, you know, not that much of a stretch. He didn't really have to act, you know?
Wasn't much of a stitch.
Huh?
Let's move on.